Hello, friends. Hey, Greg Kokel here, and I guess I sound lively to myself, but I feel tired as we are working so hard this last weekend at Rethink. I'll tell you a little bit about that, Rethink Orange County, in just a minute. But before we get started, I want to chat for a few moments with my friend Justin Brierley from the wonderful radio program Unbelievable. And Justin, you got a big event coming up in a week and a half here in Southern Cal, don't you?
Yes, we sure do. Thanks for having me on today, Greg.
Yeah, it's a treat. It's a treat to talk to you again, buddy.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's been too long. I think we're actually going to the same place you just had your Rethink conference.
We have it all warmed up for you, brother.
we're coming to bring Unbelievable, which is my radio show and podcast from the UK, out to Southern California on the 11th and 12th of October. That's next weekend, not this coming weekend, but the following.
Correct.
And we'll be at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a fantastic weekend.
Tell them just a moment, if for those who are not familiar with Unbelievable, whenever you do a conference, there is a sense that the kind of format and taste of Unbelievable is represented in a live set of circumstances. I've been on the show two or three times since whenever I get in the UK, we get to hang out a little bit together and do a show, and I've been on with some atheists and stuff. But bring folks up to speed a little bit on your concept for the show, Justin, and then we'll talk a little bit about the conference.
Sure. Well, the show itself has been going for over 10 years here in the UK and really is listened to by a lot of people now on podcasts as well all over the
mm-hmm.
world.
Right.
And essentially, it's me sitting down once a week, normally with a Christian and a non-Christian. They could be an atheist, an agnostic, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Jew. And we just talk about why one believes what they believe and the other believes the other. And we aim to have a constructive dialogue about faith.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, my you know, I'm coming at it as a Christian. I want people to see that there is intellectual strength in the Christian faith and that it can stand on its own two feet against all the objections and so on that other people bring to it. And so
mm-hmm.
we've just seen that play out in all kinds of different ways with all kinds of really interesting guests over the years. I even wrote a book about some of those
engagements,
in my case, for faith. Yeah, so it's been great.
I love your reference, Justin, to intellectual strength because, of course, I share that commitment. And it is especially evident from the fact that you field some of the toughest challengers to Christianity, and you put them, across the table from others who can answer them in an adequate way and beyond adequate, you know, in a completely efficient way and sufficient way to demonstrate that Christianity is worth thinking about. And I really appreciate your show because you don't shy away from the tough issues. Sometimes you have theological issues represented. So you have Christians from either side, I think. You've done the hell issue, for example, and some other things. But you're willing to kind of suffer peer review and let the best idea win.
Yeah, exactly. And in that sense, you know, it's the kind of show where, if you like, you know, we live slightly dangerously because we're not simply presenting the Christian case. We're saying, okay, this is the Christian case, but we're inviting the other side to have their say.
Right.
And in that sense, it's kind of like one of my friends describes it as a demilitarized zone where you've got this place where you can have this exchange of ideas and you're going to hear from both sides. And I'm going to be as neutral as I can in the moderator seat and allow both sides just to make their points. And in a way, while that's kind of dangerous in a way, because, you know, you're going to hear a cogent case against Christianity,
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to field the best on the other side as well. And actually, what we've discovered is it's had this tremendous ability by having that kind of platform to draw in not just Christians, but many non-Christians who now listen to the show. Lots of atheists who turn up for the events, for the dialogues, for the discussions. So it's given us this tremendously exciting platform to be able to actually reach out.
You did this a few years ago with Sean McDowell in the Los Angeles area, San Fernando Valley, and another atheist. It was fabulous. And folks, Justin is a master at managing these things, and I think excessively fair to both sides. So it isn't like it's two against one up there. So you do a great job, Justin. So it is that that format, though, that is going to be reproduced in the Friday evening portion of this event, Unbelievable Live in L.A., that's at Costa Mesa on the 11th and 12th of October. Tell us about Friday evening, the 11th, and the big conversation.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, the big conversation is a new series of video debates that we've been hosting from the Unbelievable Show with some really big thinkers on both sides. And we're really pleased that on Friday the 11th at Costa Mesa, we'll be hosting John Lennox, who's a well-known professor of mathematics from the Oxford University, mm-hmm. A brilliant Christian thinker, a wonderful communicator as well. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be in conversation with Dave Rubin. Now, he is a really interesting guy. He's an agnostic Jew. He runs this thing called the Rubin Report on YouTube. Mm-hmm. It's a hugely popular talk show where he sits down with some of the really interesting thinkers, both from the secular and religious world. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you'll frequently see him with people like Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro, mm-hmm. and Sam Harris and other people on his show. In fact, I think he just got done recording an edition with Ravi Zacharias that's due to go out in the next couple of weeks. But he's just an interesting character because he's already had a sort of political conversion kind of from the left to the right.
Huh.
But he also seems to be on a kind of spiritual journey, or he's certainly looking at whether there's more to life than simply the secular view. So I think he and John will have a fantastic conversation.
Sure.
We're going to be the conversation is titled "Is God Dead?" We're going to be looking at atheism, God, modern life, where people are looking for meaning, you know, in the modern world.
Well,
and I suspect, yeah, it'll be a great combo.
Yeah, I'm sure of it. I have an event the next night. I don't know if I'm going to be able to come down to Orange County on that night, but I would love to see it. I have a question, though, about Dave Rubin. Though sometimes when agnostics call themselves agnostics, they're not really agnostics. They're atheists who don't want to take any burden of proof, so they just say, well, I don't know for sure, so I must be kind of an agnostic, when in fact they're campaigning against God. Now, it doesn't sound like Dave Rubin is one of those kinds of agnostics.
That's right. I'd agree with that. I think he seems to be on a kind of spiritual search at some level. Now, it'll be interesting to see on the night how much he opens up on that front and just how much kind of he's given thought to some of the arguments for the existence of God. I know that he's certainly had those conversations with people like Ravi Zacharias. He's mm-hmm. had Bishop Robert Barron on his show not so long ago, who's an interesting guy. And so I'm fascinated to see how far we can draw the conversation out, not just from the cultural sphere, which is where he usually sort of, you know, his conversations exist, to kind of talking about, well, okay, what if there was a God? What would that mean for life? And what if we did have evidence that God is there and is actually seeking a response from all of us? And I'm really looking forward. It'll be a different, in that sense, conversation to the ones I usually have had with John Lennox on my show, where very often, even the last time I had him on was with Peter Atkins, who's just about the most hard-boiled atheist you could ever come across. And in that one, you know, all you've got is basically Peter Atkins scoffing and saying, of course God doesn't exist, you know, of course there's no evidence. And
right.
John Lennox very politely but firmly trying to explain that really there's actually quite a lot of good evidence.
Right, yeah. He's wonderfully amicable, and I've only met him once. I don't know him, but I know his onstage presence is very fetching. And he's this kind of older, round fellow that is, he's an Oxford professor and has written quite a number of books, and he knows his stuff, and he's not afraid of anyone. So he's able to maneuver quite well in these conversations. So that's going to be interesting. By the way, what is the format for that night with this conversation?
It'll very be much like what I do with a show, but with an audience in front of us. So we'll be up on stage. It'll just be the three of us on stage. We will have that conversation, you know, that opening conversation where we talk through the issues. We mm-hmm. get both their stories. We have some back and forth. And then, of course, because we've got the audience there, we'll throw it open to the audience. We'll get some questions. We'll see what comes in, and we'll see how the guests respond. And in my experience, 2 hours flies by. People love actually hearing these long-form conversations
right.
when they come out for them.
Right.
And I'm excited to be in the middle of that and to be able to host it.
You know what happens in the dynamic a little bit, I think, Justin, is when a Christian apologist or any Christian is making his or her case in a confident way, a lot of times the Christians are asking, yeah, that sounds really good, but what would someone who disagreed with you say against your view? And that becomes the real test, you know, how does your view suffer under a peer analysis or peer review? And this is precisely what you do in Unbelievable in general, and will be, of course, the format for the Friday night, the 11th of October, at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, where, as Justin said, we just were this last weekend, and we warmed up every single seat on the campus with, I'm looking at the numbers, 2,668 was the official number. Of course, that main auditorium there only holds 2,000. So we had them scattered all over the campus. But anyway, it's a great venue, and I hope you have a great time there. And that's Friday night. Now, there's more, of course, Saturday. Is there a charge for the big conversation on Friday night on the 11th?
It's $15. And then it just goes slightly up if you're going on the door on the night. But I do encourage, actually, if people are interested in attending both the Friday night and the Saturday, we've got a special kind of combo price for doing the whole weekend. So that's a good one to get hold of over at the website right now.
Okay, and that website, is that unbelievable.live? Is that it?
Yeah, that's right. That's the one. That's our live events website. So www.unbelievable.live.
Okay, so now that's just Friday night. Of course, you have an entire Saturday filled with sessions and speakers, including yourself and John Lennox. Pastor Brian Broderson will also be giving a talk. Jay Warner Wallace, who was with us this last weekend, will be one of your speakers and providing his tremendous insight into evidences for Christianity from the perspective of a former cold case homicide detective who has never lost a case that went to trial. And so when he used those skills to apply them to the legitimacy of the testimony in the New Testament, this is what brought him to Christ from atheism. So he's going to be doing at least two sessions, I think, with you. So who else in the lineup there?
Well, we're going to obviously have John Lennox staying on, and so he'll be both bringing us some great stuff in the morning. Firstly, he's going to be talking about remaining kind of true in a very post-Christian culture. Mm-hmm. He wrote a great book a couple of years ago on the lessons from the book of Daniel, staying faithful in Babylon. And we're going to kind of be looking at our modern-day Babylon and how we stay faithful as Christian thinkers and Christian evangelists. But we'll also get time to reflect, actually, on what happened the night before with John during the day. So I think that will be really interesting to kind of just pick his mind and have some reflection on what happened the night before, kind of do a little bit of a debrief on
Right. I like the care with which you put that, pick his mind, not his brain. I tell people, if you want to pick my brain, you got to be a brain surgeon. You need a scalpel. So good for you. Isn't Mary Jo Sharp's on the docket, too, right?
Mary Jo Sharp.
Houston Baptist.
Really looking forward to her being with us. She obviously has a great apologetics ministry, Confident Christianity, and she's going to be telling her story, like Jay Warner Wallace, who will tell his story of coming from atheism to Christian faith. That was the same for Mary Jo Sharp. Different kind of circumstances and a different story, but really it'll be fascinating to hear her story as well. And I think her seminar in the afternoon, actually, I think is really relevant to what's been happening in our news feeds over the summer. So we heard a lot of stories of well-known Christians saying they were deconverting or going through some kind of deconstruction.
That's right.
And she's going to be addressing that particular issue because her next book is very much on that subject.
Right.
And so she's going to be talking about deconstruction and doubt and what do we do about those who say that they're falling away from faith. So there's just going to be some really practical stuff in there, as well as the kind of some of that, the meat of, the kind of stuff J. Warner Wallace will do on the resurrection and, mm-hmm. and John will do on science and everything else. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it should be a good day.
Yeah, A.J. Roberts, also from Reasons to Believe, and Ruth Jackson from RZIM will be part of the lineup there. You've got just a fabulous lineup of really bright people that are very capable communicators. It's going to be a great event. Once again, it's Unbelievable, live in L.A., The Big Conversation, live on Friday night, the 11th of October at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. And then on Saturday, the conference proper, Unbelievable. And that would be Unbelievable with a question mark. And that's the 12th. The website, once again, is unbelievable.live. That's Dubs, unbelievable.live. Friday by itself is 15. There's an additional price for Saturday. You get them both together, you get a bargain. So go onto the website and check that out. And, you know, I'm still licking my wounds a little bit, Justin, because I missed your event in July.
Yeah.
I was between the one weekend between the Philippines and Uganda, and and that was a weekend we had a family reunion, and so I had gotten a call about being part of what you're doing there in London, and I'm telling you, oh, it was so painful to say no. Craig Hazen had contacted me. Anyway, maybe I'll get a rain check on that if you're merciful to me.
We'll see what we can do for next time, maybe. But yeah, we had a fantastic conference. Thank you. Just in July. It wasn't that long ago, actually.
So
in London. So yeah, it was great.
Right, and it might be that I can come out for the event at least on Friday night. We'll see. I've been away from my family quite a bit this summer. So, but in any event, wish you all the best there. That's Unbelievable live at LA. That's the 11th and 12th of October at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, which a place that we know well. Justin Brierley, John Lennox, Mary Jo Sharp, J. Warner Wallace, A.J. Roberts, and Ruth Jackson of RZIM. I mean, this could be great. So all the best. And by the way, is this going to be recorded, what happens on Friday night? Did I see a note
about
that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'll make the recordings available. Friday night will go out as part of this big conversation series that we're broadcasting on the Unbelievable podcast and video channel. And then all of the sessions from the conference will be made available down the line as well. So, but, you know, nothing beats being there in person, as you know.
Yeah.
So, we're looking forward to seeing and meeting lots of friends of the show when we get there on the 11th and 12th.
All right, Justin. All the best to you, brother. And if I don't see you, I'll see you here, there, or in the air, as they say.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll get you over to the UK soon enough for my conference.
Okay.
Greg. Okay.
That would be wonderful.
All right.
I'm going to patch some days on either side of that so my wife can come out and we can enjoy the wonderful UK. The best of vacations I've ever had without a fishing pole.
Wow. Marvelous.
Okay, Justin, thanks so much.
Thanks, Greg. God bless you guys.
Bye-bye now. Justin Brierley, again, the program is Unbelievable. And that would be with a question mark, like I said. And the event, October 11th and 12th, Calvary Chapel, unbelievable.live. All right, let's take a break, and we'll be back with your calls on Stand to Reason.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR Videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR Videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible, and relevant content each week? As a nonprofit ministry, we rely on generous supporters in order to provide the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including apps, blog posts, articles, or short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. When you visit str.org/donate, you'll find a newly renovated transaction page that makes it easier than ever to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources over the past 25 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Please help us to continue on into the next 25 years by making a gift today at str.org/donate.
All right, back at you here, Greg Kokel, and a couple of quick things here. First of all, I already mentioned the Orange County Rethink 2,668. Oh, man, I'm getting my numerals mixed up. That's the biggest Rethink we've ever had. However, Minnesota is chomping at the heels here of Orange County because though it's got to be 6 weeks or so away, maybe seven, we've already got 1,521 signed up. Now, our biggest launch ever was 1,600 at Birmingham a few years back. We're easily going to go over this. We might blow right through the total of 2,668, which is our max at Orange County, the biggest we've ever had, and that would be on our launch in Minneapolis. If you want more information about the Minneapolis event, which is November 8th and 9th, you can go to RethinkApologetics.com. We're going to be at Grace Church in Eden Prairie, which is the largest church in the state. And the same lineup of speakers we just had, so if you weren't able to make that event, you can make this one, with the exception of Sean McDowell won't be there, but Frank Turek will be there instead. So, you know, it's just a fair trade-off. Jim Wallace will be there, Christopher Yuan, the whole Stand to Reason team, of course. Is Drew Worship going to be there? I'm not sure. Okay, in any event, though, it's going to be fabulous as we launch out there in the Midwest with Rethink in Minneapolis. By the way, we've had a number of people ask me about something that I talked about 3 or 4 weeks ago, where my wife went to a board meeting for the school board in our community, Thousand Oaks, because there was a trend or a move to put some very controversial sexual material, in the curriculum for the school. And this was all affirming of the gender fluidity notions. And so I wasn't able to go to that, but I did write a piece that my wife was able to read. And she had like 3 minutes. And so I wrote about a 2.5 minute piece that was meant to make a case against what was being proposed. And the substance of the case that I made was attempt to leverage their own thinking against them. If we live in a diverse community and we believe in diversity, then we ought not be championing one particular viewpoint on a controversial subject that has nothing to do with our children's proper education. And that is the gender ideology. There are lots of people who don't agree with that. And this is something that parents should be involved in teaching their children. It should not be something that is imposed upon children against the parents' will when it is a controversial issue about sexuality and sexual identity. There are a lot of things that, even though we're in a diverse community, we have one mind on, and that includes the standard virtues of kindness and respect and tolerance and honesty and hard work and all of these kinds of things. If the school wants to advance non-controversial elements, moral elements that are held largely by the entire community, there's no problem there. But when they use the platform of the school to indoctrinate according to a very narrow, politicized point of view about sexuality, then they are flying in the face of the doctrine of pluralism and diversity that they think is so important. And so that was my basic approach. I read it on the air, what I wrote. It was posted wherever Amy posts these kinds of things, so you'll know where to find it. But people have been asking, what was the upshot there? The upshot simply was that my wife got to share it, and it seemed like she got a good response from the audience. Many of the things that were said were not, shall we say, as substantive. I was really working to do a lot of work. I was writing in such a way that the writing would do a lot of work in 3 minutes. And so it's, people received it well. I don't know the final outcome of the policy concerns, and maybe that's still in process. I do know, and we got some information from others who were listening and reading what Amy had posted, that they used the piece that I wrote in similar circumstances in their own communities and in their own states. In one case, folks asked permission to use it, and I don't have any problem with that. And frankly, a thing like that, you're welcome to just use, all right? I don't make it, call it your own, but I, you know, publish it as an article with your name on it. But that, if you just want to employ it in what you're doing, you could read the same statement, and that's what happened. To some salutary effect, from what I understand. So I was glad that this became a little bit of a leveraged effect, but enterprise rather. But at the same time, what was most important for me was to have an impact in my local community for what I believed, and to give good reasons for it and not just emote, to appeal to an ethic that was reasonable and, as it turned out, was their ethic, what they claim is their ethic, diversity and tolerance. Now, diversity and tolerance is a one-way street, as many of you know. But nevertheless, we still can take our best shot and leverage it against them in an appropriate way. And that's what we did there. So there's an update on that particular item. All right, let's go to the callers. And in Oklahoma, it's Gary. Hello, Gary.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm a little bit tired. We had a long couple of days, but still haven't recovered from it all. But I'm glad to chat with you right now.
Okay. Well, I had a thought some weeks ago, and I've really been thinking about this, and I've actually employed it in a witnessing situation to good effect. And I So the question is this: if Christianity were to be conclusively and definitively proven false, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? Now, I want to stress, I don't want to get into how Christianity would be proven false, because
right,
that's a different issue.
Sure.
But if it were conclusively and definitively proven false, would that be a good thing or a bad thing?
I'm curious, you said you've used this in a couple of situations. How is it that you employed this question in your circumstances?
Well, I got to give away the answer to do that.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I don't mind going first, so we'll come back to that.
Sure.
My simple and general answer is it depends on what turned out to be true instead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, let's say we don't know what would turn out to be true instead.
Oh, I see. Okay. But it just turned out that Christianity was false. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then what I'd say is the gospel is a word that means good news.
Mm-hmm.
And if Christianity is true, then the news is very, very good. That news being that there is a God who made us and who cares about us and who reached down to rescue us from ourselves. And the rescue is free. And the rescue continues forever. And all of the anguish of the brokenness of this world and our individual brokenness will eventually be repaired in such a way that the brokenness of this world will shrink down to an infinitesimally small portion of our experience, our lives. And that's 2 Corinthians 4, 16 through 18, the weight of glory passage there. And so if that's true, this is what eventuates, okay? It also, though, you know, has a downside, and that is, given that we're guilty, there is opportunity for mercy, but because of justice, apart from mercy, there is punishment. Good news is, in the face of punishment, there is mercy available, okay? Now, if all of that turned out to be false, that is the Christian accounting of reality in general, I don't think that would mean that morality would be false, because there are different ways to ground morality apart from Christianity. I think you would need God to ground morality, but if God is theoretically still in the picture, and there is good and bad that happen in the world and that we do, well, then I think you have a different issue. The good news is no longer good because it's false. So now what? Now what? And what of the motivation through the changed lives Christians have had and experienced in Christ to transform the world for what many would argue are clearly good results, like the educational system and hospitals and slavery and all that. That was all done in virtue of a commitment to a person, Jesus of Nazareth. And even if morality was still intact with Christianity being false, because there is morality and there would be a God to ground it of some sort, it seems like the motivation might not be the same. So it seems the net loss would be bad. Ultimately, no good news, only bad news, and no good result from the good news in the lives of others. So that's kind of, off the top of my head, the assessment I'd make.
Well, the way I looked at it was that if Christianity were conclusively and definitively proven false, that would have to be a good thing. And my reasoning on that is simply this. I don't want to live or believe something that is false. And therefore, I don't care how comforting it is. I don't care how it makes me feel, or the social group that I'm in, or, all of those things. I just think that the answer really should be, and is that if Christianity were definitively proven false, that would be a good thing, because there's one less metaphysical belief system out there that we need to consider in our search for the truth. And by the way, Amy wrote me back this terrific dissertation going through about, 10 different things I'd never thought of before. It was
on
really,
this question?
Really good.
On this question?
On this question. So let me say this, and Greg, I've talked to you before. I believe that the truth of Christianity is a fait accompli. I believe it's
bomb
truly
proof,
complete.
Right.
I believe it's truly complete. But the thing is, honestly, let me give you the example where I use this in witnessing.
Well, wait, let me jump in here, because you're talking for a while.
I have a thought on this.
I'm actually kind of surprised by your response, though I understand there's a virtue in not believing something false.
Right.
In this particular case, whatever it turned out to be that was false would embody that virtue. You'd say, well, good, mm-hmm. It's one less thing that's false that I have to go through. But what you've done is you've lost an option that itself has what appears to be magnificent intrinsic value. And so to me, it sounds like what you're saying, I think it would be a good thing if I found out that I didn't win the lottery when I thought I won $20 million. And the reason it's good is because now I'm not believing something false.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, the alternative is that it's true and you benefit from the $20 million. And so I would think if you got news that you won $20 million and then it turned out that was bogus, you wouldn't say, that's good. It's because now I won't believe something false. No, I think you're going to think it's bad because you thought you were going to get something really wonderful and now you're not going to get it. And your booby prize is you're not going to believe something that's false.
But let's take your example. Let's say that you thought you had won the lottery, and it turns out that you had not won the lottery, and so you found out the truth. You're much better off finding out the truth, because you wouldn't have gotten the money either way. That you would have simply been delusional in thinking you had won the lottery when you actually had not. So then you learn that, no, it's false, I didn't win it. You're ahead of the game. You're not going to go out and make mistakes based upon a false belief system.
Well, and, I take the question to be, would it be good or bad if the question was true or false? I mean, if the issue is true or false. And I think it would be a great good if Christianity actually were true. And if it were false, then all that great good would not be there. Just like it would be a great good to win the lottery, although most people go broke in a year afterwards anyway, and it ruins their lives. But that aside, and if it was one or the other, that would be certainly be good to have it. And if the good that you would have, you would lose if it weren't the case.
But Greg, here's the thing. The issue I take with that perspective is this.
Okay, I'm going to let you have the last word here. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The issue I would simply take is this: if something is false, and that means that something else is true. Okay. And if and I don't want to live according to a false belief, and therefore, for me, it comes down to I want to know what's actually true.
Sure, I'm with
therefore,
you.
Therefore, if Christianity was proven conclusively false, I would have to say that was a good thing.
Okay.
If I can interject for 30 seconds, I was talking with a family friend who is a committed Mormon, and I was talking to this Mormon about the fact that I really believed that if we're honest with ourselves, then we would have to say that if Christianity were proven conclusively false, that would be a good thing. And he thought about it for a while, and we discussed it back and forth. And then I asked him the question. I said, Mark, if Mormonism were conclusively and definitively proven false, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? And I am telling you, the silence spoke volumes about his doubt about Mormonism. It spoke volumes.
Mm-hmm.
I can say it's a good thing from my perspective because, frankly, I believe all of the evidence of the story of reality is on the side of Christianity being true.
I'm with you on that.
Therefore, I can be confident in saying if it's proven false, that's a good thing because I want to be on the side of truth.
Well,
so anyway.
I mean, the only thing that I would just interject, because I said you have the last word, is that if Mormonism is false, it doesn't matter because it's not good news to begin with. Christianity is magnificent news, and maybe that's where the difference is. Anyway, I appreciate the banter, Gary.
You bet.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care,
buddy.
Bye-bye now.
Sure, bye-bye.
All right. Let's see. I'm going to check the clock. Oh, I got to go to another break. We got lots of people on the phone. We're going to keep talking. We're going to go in the next hour with some of you, which is fine. Okay? So don't get antsy. Don't hang up. We'll get to you. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Since Scripture calls Christians ambassadors for Christ, how do we fulfill that role when it comes to Islam? I submit the answer is exactly the same way a political ambassador would fulfill their role. Ambassadors do two things. They learn and engage. You see, they learn about the people they're going to visit, and then they engage those people. And ambassadors for Christ should do the same. We need to learn about Islam and then engage Muslims. Now, the challenge that many Christians face, though, is that they don't know much about Islam. And even when they think they do, they're often misinformed. And this can lead to unhelpful stereotypes, prejudice, fear, or syncretism. That's why I've created a video training tool called A Closer Look at Islam. And that's to equip ambassadors for Christ who are ready to heed the call to learn about Islam and engage Muslims. Now, my goal in this resource is to provide believers with an accessible introduction to the most important elements of the Islamic faith. And that way they can draw upon this knowledge of Islam to more carefully craft their message when they meet Muslims. I also wanted to combine this knowledge with practical tactics. For example, I show believers how they can determine which beliefs and practices are truly Islamic and which are not. Also, I explain how to respond to the most common objection that Muslims raise, and that is, the Bible has been corrupted. A Closer Look at Islam is available on DVD or HD on demand. You'll find the link to our online store at the top of the homepage at str.org.
All right, back at you here. Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. By the way, our call-in number is 855-243-9975. That's any time between 4 and 6 p.m. on Tuesdays. Actually, don't call it 6 p.m. on Tuesdays because we're all done by then. But that's the slot, and that's Los Angeles time. So you keep track of that, do the math, and give us a call here. Amy will pick up for you and most likely put you up. Wait, Amy, have you ever turned anybody down? Once. Okay. Yeah, so she's pretty easy. All right, let's go to Josh in Florida. Let me find the button there. Okay, Josh, you're on. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Good. I just wanted to call in, and I guess my question is really regarding the biblical inerrancy. You know, I've been exploring this topic a little bit, and I listened to Bill Craig and him discuss it, and what I found is that he seems to hold that it's not really a fundamental doctrine of the Christian faith. Obviously, you can be a Christian without holding to it. I get that.
Right.
And I think you hold that as well.
Yeah, it's never been articulated anywhere in the last 2,000 years as a essential doctrine, theologically.
Sure.
Right.
Right. So I guess the difficulty for me in this is I agree with that, but the problem for me is I think if there are issues or errors in the scriptures, I don't see how we could trust really anything at that point. How do we know? Because then we're left to just figure out what is true and what's not, and how do we really know that? And that's kind of what I've kind of stopped at. I don't really know where to go from there.
Sure. Well, let me offer a response. First of all, those of us who think inerrancy is not a core doctrine, in most cases, still believe in inerrancy. And we believe in it for the reason, for in a certain sense, logical reasons. If the Bible is God's word and God can't err, then the Bible can't err. Then if we demonstrate that there are good reasons to believe that it is God's word, and we have multiple lines of argument to pursue in that regard, then our conclusion seems to follow, okay, that it is inerrant. And also I would say for those who have abandoned inerrancy, what seems to follow after that is a degradation of theology for the reason that you suggested. Because people think, well, if I can't trust that it's really true on the authority of the Bible itself, well, then maybe I can monkey with the doctrine here to find what suits me or what suits the culture. And I think that's a liability. However, I just want to speak more to the epistemic or epistemological or knowledge issue of how can you get truth out of a book that's not inerrant. And the answer to that is we do it all the time. So when people say to me, well, the Bible is only written by men, I say, so what? It was written by men, so therefore what? And that's kind of my variation of what do you mean by that? What's the problem there? Well, men make mistakes, and they do, therefore what? Well, then the Bible has mistakes. Well, that doesn't follow, first of all, that because men make mistakes, that in this particular document they did make mistakes. That's one problem. And secondly, even where human beings make mistakes, it doesn't mean that we can't trust the information that is given there. So my next question is, do you have any books in your library? Of course. Okay, who wrote those? Humans or monkeys or angels or God? No, human beings wrote them. Why do you have books in your library then that were written by fallible human beings, yet you still consider them valuable in some way? And the answer is because sometimes in those books they give solid reasons to believe the claims that they're making. And that's why I don't think the substance of Christianity rests on inerrancy. If we made that the case, then all we'd have to do to destroy Christianity is to find what appears to be an error or more, but one would be enough to show that this could not be God's book. And this is, of course, what people try to do. I don't argue inerrancy with non-Christians because I don't think it's relevant to the message. The early church did not have an inerrant Bible that they drew from on a regular basis. They had reliable testimony about Jesus' death and resurrection. And that's the thing that matters. As the apostles wrote their letters, and they were later gathered into tomes, That means into books of sort. This didn't happen, by the way, till 3rd or 4th century. But as they did, then we have the Bible as we know it, and they could draw from. Before that, though, they had the accounts of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, which as people retold those accounts, they weren't inerrant retellings, but they were substantive, and they had truthful elements in, because these elements were communicated by eyewitnesses in many cases. And so so I don't think what this does, and now I'm not campaigning for against inerrancy here, but I just want to be careful that we don't dig a hole for ourselves that we won't be able to get out of. I don't think that we have to campaign for inerrancy in order to make the case for the Bible. I'm sorry, for Christianity. And we can encourage people to draw from the Word, from this record, ancient record of the things people saw and things Jesus did, and also what the apostles wrote about theological matters, without demanding inerrancy from them that a person, before somebody takes seriously the writings of these insightful men. That's what I'm trying to avoid. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It does. I guess, can I just come back with one, I guess, rebuttal? So let's pretend in that case, and I believe in inerrancy personally, but I guess for me, one of the things that comes to my mind would be, well, if it has errors, then, you know, the primary source of information that we have about Jesus, at least today, comes from the Bible. So how do we distinguish? How do we distinguish what is true, especially because he makes significant claims to be the Son of God and things like that? So how do we reconcile that?
Well, I don't think it's quite as hard as you make it sound, because instead of taking the truthfulness of the words based on the authority of the Scripture, we can take the truthfulness of the words based on the authority of Jesus. Now, I'm talking here about Jesus, the historical individual, who we have good reason to believe from the testimony of the witnesses, actually died and rose again from the dead. And because he did this, this puts him in a special position to speak with authority about spiritual things. And as long as we have a reasonably accurate characterization of what Jesus taught, we're in pretty good shape. We also have four different accounts of it. So we have multiple accounts from different perspectives written by different people, even though there was some trading back and forth and some sharing of information. We have multiple accounts, and this is one of the characteristics of an historically reliable record, that there are multiple accounts. And in these accounts, we have other details that are significant to trusting the veracity of those accounts. I talk about it a bit in The Story of Reality. I have a chapter where I address some of those things. I talk about the person of Jesus and the records of his life and why we can trust them without, at the same time, me making the case for inerrancy. I don't know if that helps with your follow-up concern, but...
No, it does. It does. And I think one of the things that helped me as well, I think when you did, I think you did like a 5-minute video on this, was you said that the people in the New Testament didn't have the New Testament.
Right. That was the point I was making just a little earlier. Correct.
Right. Right. And I think that's very helpful. Mm-hmm. I didn't consider that. So.
Yeah. So the question of inerrancy only comes up when you have the corpus of Scripture there to assess. Mm-hmm. And this didn't come till later when they bound them together in what are called codices. Like you have a Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus. This is a bound copy, what we would call a Bible. But these were not bound until the 2nd or 3rd or 4th century, and so there were pieces floating around, but nobody had something like the Bible. They took the words of Paul to be authoritative because Paul, like Peter and John, were trained by Jesus. They were apostles. They had the authority of Christ invested in them, and so they were the rule, as it were, the standard. And that word canon comes from the concept of rule or standard. So they were the canon, and once they died, it was their writings that were the canon. So anyway, just a little bit of additional information for you.
Sure, sure. Thank you.
All right, Josh, I enjoyed talking to you. Thanks for the question. Let's see. We got Mark in Arkansas. Jonesboro, Arkansas. Mark.
Hi, Greg.
Or is Mark Jonesboro your name and you live in Arkansas?
No, Mark is my name and I live in Jonesboro.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Hi.
Right. Well, thanks so much for taking my call, and thank you for everything that you do and everybody at Stand to Reason. I'm a longtime listener, and my family and I have benefited greatly from the ministry. We're strategic partners,
thank
and I just
you.
Want to recommend to all the listeners out there that if you've benefited at all from this ministry, consider becoming a financial partner with it. It is an incredibly great resource and an incredibly good investment for the kingdom.
Well, bless you, my son.
Thank you.
I appreciate your gratitude. It really satisfies our hearts to hear that and to hear your recommendation. Thank you.
Good deal. Good deal. My question comes about because I've been asked to teach our Sunday school class this next Sunday, and part of the text that we'll be in is John 15:1-11.
Right.
And I've been wrestling with verse 7 for several days now and other verses like it, which seem to indicate a very broad promise that whatever we ask for in prayer, that it's going to be granted.
Yes.
And
there is a qualification there, if you abide in me and my words abide in you. So there's a qualification. Sometimes these strong promises do have qualifications, and that would be one of them.
Right, I understand. The thing is, part of the sting of this for me is we all know people or instances of people that leave very godly lives that, as far as we know, were abiding and did have faith or some of the other qualifications that are in some of these other verses, but they didn't get what they were asking for.
Right.
And so my question is, how do we reconcile unanswered prayer with promises like this without doing violence to the context?
Well, I mean, I just was thinking C.S. Lewis would be an example of that as well, losing his wife late in life, his wife of late in life, losing her late in life. So he was single most of his life. And then, so I have struggled over this passage myself and continue to do so. And Craig Hazen has written a book, a smallish book, about this passage. Are you familiar with it?
I am not.
Amy, do you have that? Craig Hazen's book on John 15, the one prayer? She's trying to think of it, but she'll figure it out. I think we have one in the back. She's just running to find it. So I would suggest that you read his book. I have, and it was helpful. But what is it? Fearless Prayer. Okay, thank you, Amy. Fearless, this name, this voice started coming out of nowhere because I saw her run away and all of a sudden it was in my head. She had come back, I had noticed. Fearless Prayer by Craig Hazen. And so it's something you could probably get overnight or in 2 days from Amazon. And then it's a quick read, all right? And
Now,
he makes the point that in the passage there are a number of qualifications that are important. One qualification is the one I just mentioned, but another qualification is implicit, and that is Jesus is responding for the purpose that the Christian bears much fruit.
Right.
Okay. James says, "You ask not, you have not, because you ask not." Okay. So there's a problem. You don't have answers to prayers. You never pray. That's one problem. But then he says, but then you ask and then you don't receive because you ask with wrong motives. So there's a possibility there that that might factor in. And 1 Peter chapter 3, Paul warns that if husbands are mistreating of their wives, then that's going to hinder their prayers as well. But in this particular passage, we have some qualifiers. But even with the qualifiers in place, it looks like a pretty bold promise. And Craig Hazen considers it a pretty bold promise as well. A frustration for me, though, is that I have prayed for a number of very, very important things that it seems to me fulfill the requirements of this passage that God has not said yes to. So I am somewhat with the same question that you have. What I'm inclined to think is that promises like this are not, in a certain sense, airtight. Jesus is not meaning to make a promise that every single prayer that you pray following these things is going to result in what you want, following these guidelines. But he's praying, he's giving a generalization. And there are sometimes exceptions, because even though we have in our mind what would bear fruit for God as we're abiding in Christ, it may be that God has some other fruitfulness in mind. I'll just give you an example, a general example. Someone struggling in a relationship, maybe a marriage relationship or a relationship with a child, and the relationship has gone south. And one could pray, well, Lord, your word seems to depict a certain quality of relationship as ideal for us with children or us with our spouses, and that's not happening here. And so I'm praying for that ideal, and it's still not coming. Why is it that when I pray according to your revealed will, I'm not getting what I want? And the answer might very well be, in fact, many people listening could attest to this, that the delay in getting the answer was required for God to use the troublesome relationship to do other work in lives, maybe other people's lives or maybe our own, that absolutely needed to be done for God's broader and deeper and more significant purpose and plan to be fulfilled.
Right.
And see, that's the kind of thing we can't see, and that's when it's hard then when those happen. I'm offering this kind of anecdotally because I think all of us have had prayers that went unanswered, and then we look back and we think, okay, either I'm glad that didn't get answered the way I prayed it, or we think I'm glad it didn't get answered when I prayed it, because there was something that desperately needed to happen in my life that would not have happened if the hardship, difficulty, pain had been removed when I asked it to be removed.
Right.
So, how does that work with John 15?
Okay.
I mean, that particular thing isn't in there.
Right.
But if one takes this not as a cast iron promise, which you and I know it can't be. Because that if it's a cast iron promise, then it's one that God hasn't kept.
Right. Well, I mean,
there must be some flexibility in that. That's all I'm saying.
Right. I definitely believe that there are other issues that come into it, and God's sovereignty and His plan and His timing and all of those things. But I guess that's kind of why I phrased the question like I did, with without doing violence to the context, because I was kind of looking to see if there was anything in the passage itself that might point to some of those things that would limit, you know, the scope of it, because it does seem to be a very bold promise.
It does. Yeah. I got to jump in here because my music's up here, Mark, and I think you're right. I'm with you, you know, step for step on this, and same questions I ask myself. So apart from those things specified, then what? Well, then it's just the mind of God, and we do our best in the midst of the confusion. So I wish I had a better answer for you and for me. But anyway, there it is. Thank you for the call, Mark. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give him heaven this week. Bye-bye now.